The Rad Podcast is brought to you by MoFo, male optimization formula with organs to boost testosterone. Brad's Macadamia Masterpiece, mind-blowing nut butter blend, now offered on Amazon. Chili Technology, temperature-controlled mattress systems for a good night's sleep. InsideTracker.com, offering blood, DNA, and fitness tracking data all in one place. And Organifi, whole food organic superfood supplements and drink blends. And please visit the shopping page at bradkearns.com for my personal selection of favorite products for health, fitness, and peak performance with great discounts for listeners. Here we go with the show.
It would be awesome if being a world champion was just a matter of being mentally tough and just grinding yourself down to a nub every day. Like, that's easy. What the real trick is figuring out how to pulse that. You know, it's like, when do you have to drive forward? When do you need to reel it back in? And what I've noticed, and this is part of the reason why I kind of lost interest in really working with, like, elite athletes, is that my main role as a coach was acting as a speed bump. The big problem that I see with people using fasting as, say, like the sole means of weight loss is someday you have to eat again. And the food that you were eating before is this hyperpalatable processed crap that you know, bypasses the neuroregulation of appetite and encourages us to overeat. And so if fasting is kind of the main tool you use, then you didn't likely develop tools and patterns that are going to allow you to navigate the modern world. Nutrients tend to be more densely associated with protein-rich foods. And so any organism you care to look at, they tend to favor more protein-dense sources of nutrition because they get more broad nutrition in that context.
Oh my gosh, I am so excited and inspired by this incredible conversation with the Paleo founding father himself, New York Times best-selling author, mover, shaker, disruptor. It's Rob Wolf, catching up from his current home in Texas, but he's on the move again. He's gone from California to Nevada to Central Texas, and now he fixin' to move on up to Montana and continue with his passion for Brazilian jiu-jitsu at 48 years old. He's looking and feeling better than ever. He's going to tell us why, and he's also going to get a little spicy and controversial, and that's what I love about this guy and is so inspiring. Right at the time where I'm kind of reflecting on my role as a host and how I communicate and what's important to me. And I'm aspiring to be more straight shooting, more revealing, and not so polite and withholding when I think something's bullshit or something sounds funny. And oh my gosh, after interviewing Dr. Paul Saladino recently, and then Rob, oh man, you just realize that these guys who are the true movers and shakers and thought leaders of the community are putting it out there, and they don't care what people think. They're telling their truth and they're calling out the bullshit. So turn on your bullshit meters, people, because Rob is freewheeling and throwing it out there. He talks about how he sustained a severe back injury doing a inappropriate CrossFit workout at the hands of now disgraced CrossFit founder Greg Glassman. So that kind of sucks that the guy blew up his business and caused a severe injury to Rob Wolf. He goes on to discuss how the popular, the hallowed Blue Zones movement, you know, those pockets of centenarians around the globe and the intense study that's turned into the best-selling book in the lifestyle movement. He says it's almost an entire hoax and that these Blue Zones are pockets of high rates of pension fraud and poor birth keeping records. And there's research and articles you can find. We'll link to them to back up what Rob's saying. He goes on to challenge and toss out Dave Asprey's ridiculous and commonly repeated notion that he was going to live to be 180 years old with all his biohacking. And man, it's getting spicy. It's fun, but it's real and it's raw. And I think you're going to love it. We proceed from one topic to another. That one that's really interesting is that there's this second guessing of the hallowed benefits of fasting. And you're going to find out why maybe we've gone overboard with this fascination with intermittent fasting, especially for fit, healthy people. And we might want to pay more attention to preserving muscle mass rather than protecting against cancer by not eating so much. And that's just a little bit of what Rob gets into. We're going to talk about the rationale and benefits of electrolyte supplementation, an area where a lot of people mess up, especially when they transition over into a keto low-carb diet. And he's got his wonderful operation called Element. So you'll learn about the importance of electrolyte supplementation, so many other topics. It's a great show. It's going to rock your world. The one and only Rob Wolf. Here we go. Rob Wolf, what a pleasure to connect again. It's been a long time. We passed each other in the hallways at the trade shows. We had you up to the Lake Tahoe Primal Con many years ago. That was a great retreat up there. But you're a guy on the move, so I think we better start out by checking in on this this global travel relocation schedule of the Wolf family.
Yeah, well, it's nothing I really wanted to do, but we gave a shot down in a Texas. We really like it, but most of Nikki's family lives kind of out in the West, more like Reno and Idaho, and we may have some leverage on them to move somewhere else, but it's not Texas. So we're looking at trying to rally the whole family somewhere around like Wyoming or Montana. So we're looking at maybe scooting towards Montana sometime in the spring. So yeah.
Just to depart from a health show into the economic realm, it seems like there's going to be a mass sort of relocation or exodus from the urban areas prompted by the quarantine, of course. But I'm also thinking that just the explosion of culture and the internet and all these things where now you can go waltz into some, you know, podunk town in Montana and there's a CrossFit box and there's cool people at the health food store and hikers and mountain bikers. And it seems amazing to me to see this explosion.
It's cool. It's a double-edged sword. The irony is that a lot of what makes these people want to flee the urban areas, those people screw it up in short order. I think that a little bit of respect for the indigenous culture of an area that you move to would be helpful instead of going in and immediately changing everything in your kind of utopian worldview. Maybe tread lightly and try to blend in and assimilate a little bit might go a long way towards, you know, making fewer ruffles and actually keeping the place nice because it was nice for reasons different than oftentimes the places that you're leaving. So yeah, not to get overly political in that, but yes.
A public service announcement for all of those of you wishing to move to cool places. Yes, it's easy to spoil. You know, I lived in Auburn for a long time out in, you know, far suburb of Sacramento and the hub of Western States endurance running and the trails and everything. And people would come up there from town, you know, for their weekend trail run. And you'd see all this litter on the trail, like their energy gel packets and stuff they shouldn't even be consuming anyway if they were eating a proper diet. But it was like, you know, there's someone going to pick up after them or some kind of mentality where they're just not really, they're in nature, but they're not understanding the whole scene or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny because I am from Northern California originally, but we've been in Texas coming up on 2 years. And I have a bit of an Arkansas drawl from my mom. And I forget what I was in some crowd of people and there was some shenanigans happening. And the guy, I was chatting with a guy and he was like, well, clearly you're a local here like me. And so that was kind of cool. That was kind of cool that I passed the Central Texas sniff test, at least at some superficial level. So yeah, like treading lightly, it goes a long way towards, you know, making for good neighbors. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, we'll look forward to a future update, another relocation in store. I love the idea of rallying the family, and I've moved to the places that I love the most, and that's important. But I feel sad that you know, we've kind of chased careers or personal preference at the expense of having that nucleus of family that some people, you know, have for generations and generations. And now it's so easy to move to a cool new place. But yeah, how are you going to do that? What are your enticements?
Well,
you know, dinner every Saturday night. It's a gourmet meal. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're in a similar spot where they, with so many unknowns in the world, just kind of wanting to have that like kind of base of operations for sure. And part of the thing that's drawing us to this area of Montana is that the Straight Blast Gym organization that I'm a part of with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, there's several gyms there, and they're 10, 11 years old. They have a really deep culture there and a lot of folks. And so I guess somewhat similar to like plugging into a CrossFit gym or something like that. You can transplant and plug into something like that. And it kind of accelerates the kind of developing some local networks and friends. And both our daughters are 6 and 8. And so they're enjoying Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, but what they really enjoy is having friends to play with. You know, we homeschool them. And so that's a primary part of their socialization. So in addition to hopefully getting our biological family closer to us, we have this jiu-jitsu family that is already there. And, you know, we just need to, again, plug in and tread lightly and should fare pretty well on that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, good luck. And speaking of jiu-jitsu, I just saw this shocking social media post where you said you're 48 years old and still looking good and feeling good. And I'm like, wait a second. The boy wonder of the paleo movement is now 48 years old. Oh my gosh, time is flying. But I am curious. You look great. You said you're fitter than ever. And this seems like a heavy contact sport that it seems like there's a point where you might want to transition out of that. But I'm just curious in general how you're fitness regimen has changed over the years and your competitive athletic goals. You're still hanging in there on the jiu-jitsu mat, which is amazing, but let's get an update in that realm.
Yeah. I just got my brown belt, which is pretty cool. You know, it's a no small accomplishment. I've been pretty consistent for 8 years, so I have made some good progress on that.
It's not like an honorary, it's not an honorary Rob Wolf brown belt, like an honorary PhD from some school. You had to actually earn it.
Well, here's the deal with jiu-jitsu. You don't want an honorary anything, because all that getting an advancement does is paint a bigger target on you. And something that will cause people to quit is to get a new belt and they weren't really ready for it. And then there's an expectation of performance there. And you get your ass kicked and you're clearly not where you should be, and that'll bounce you. So it is a place where participation trophies will get you murdered in that scene. So it usually has some substance to it. And there is different considerations. If I was 24 and you know, a super hard go-getter, then there would be different, you know, standards and considerations around that. But part of the reason why I like this Straight Blast Gym organization, people train plenty hard. They have world champions. People are go-getters, but it has a culture of really measured on-ramp. Like, you don't just throw people to the sharks. This is kind of, again, for a CrossFit analogy, I guess. When we ran our gym, which was the fourth affiliate gym in the world, we discovered pretty quickly that just throwing people into the standard class was a great way to get them to quit. Like, if we just wanted to like beat everybody down and show them how not fit they were, then that was fantastic. And we had like 5 people in the gym, and you have no way to make a living off of it. And so these Straight Blast gyms are very well run. They have fundamentals classes that get people kind of work hardened and ramp them up, and then they slowly expose them to the more live rolling and whatnot. And it varies from place to place, but there's definitely a strong culture of that there. And I just tap early, and I'm a little bit selective with who I roll with. If you've got kind of a young hard charging knucklehead, I may tell them, hey, you gotta be a little bit mellow, or I'm just not going to train with you, you know. So I think that is a lot of what goes into longevity with this thing. Nikki just got her blue belt, and we train together a lot. And if I wanted to smash her, I could, but then I don't have one of my best training partners to work with, and I don't get better and she doesn't get better. So you really have to be committed to getting the thing that needs to be most important is your love of jiu-jitsu, not winning. If winning every single match is your singular goal, then you're going to get hurt and you're going to have a very short tenure in the process. So it's got to be about more things other than just like winning every single match. And so when I train with Nikki, I would start off, say, like, she may have a choke like 95% sunk in, and then using posture and you know, subtle movements, can I get out of that versus like exploding and freaking out and breaking her wrist in the process, you know? And so there's a lot of interesting things that you can do. And she'll choke me 8 times out of 10, but then I'll keep chipping away at it. And then she chokes me 7 times out of 10, and then 5 times out of 10. And it's all not using strength. It's using, you know, can I posture my shoulder against her choking arm in a way that then allows me to, you know, sink down and wiggle out and not even use. It's pretty cool when you can get to where you can get out of a rear naked choke not using your hands at all, as an example. Yeah,
it sounds pretty graceful instead of just raw power. You're also working on your technique at all times and can spar with a opponent of a disparate ability where both of you guys gain so much from it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, we all, I think, endeavor to be as fit as we can, as long as we can. But if you build a game purely around attributes, strength, explosiveness, speed, what have you, then you have a game that every 5 years you're going to have to go in and take the transmission out and change it, because we are getting older. And even though I may be fit for a nearly 50-year-old guy, when I was 35, I mean, physicality wise, I would have murdered my current self. Like, I could, at 32, I could power clean and push jerk 350 pounds at about 175 pounds. Like, I was pretty strong, pretty explosive. And I still do okay with stuff, but I mean, it's fractional compared to what it was 2 decades ago. So this is another thing that I think is cool about jiu-jitsu, is that if you approach it with the right mindset, so long as you're focusing on technical progress, until you die, you can keep improving technique. And so even though you want to maintain fitness as much as you can, I don't lose anything or win anything based off of my physicality. I try to make it 100% dependent on my technique. And a lot of that is just learning how to lay like a slovenly old man on people and make them carry my weight like a backpack. But that is different than like a max effort trying to manipulate them in the way that I want them to go.
So speaking of the aging question in general, you just referenced what 15 years ago when you were at your peak numbers and all that. Now, if you're, let's say your life depended on it, or someone gave you an incentive of, you know, $100 million, if you can go back, turn the clock back and dedicate your entire life to performance here in present day, what are the factors at play biologically that have caused this familiar decline? And you've probably delayed it. I like to think I've delayed it as well as any human could by putting all our parameters into play. But let's say you had, you know, the performance labs and nothing else to do in life, so all your energy could go toward back into the powerlifting competition. What's inhibiting you from getting back to there? Or could you, if you had this perfect life where you became the elite athlete of middle age?
So one thing is, I ironically had a very severe back injury in 2005 at the hands of Greg Glassman, the founder of CrossFit. And he cooked up a new workout with these things called glute ham bench sit-ups. And my initial exposure to them was 75. And I ended up with basically compartmental syndrome, you know, abdo, my abs. It was almost a diastasis recti, like when women have, you know, where their abs separate due to pregnancy, issues. But I was pretty broken from that. It was terrible programming, terrible initial exposure. But I was in the Santa Cruz area for a couple of months, and so training at the original gym pretty frequently. And it was maybe 12 days later that we were pulling max deadlifts, and I had close to 500 pounds on the bar, which normally is not that big of a deal for me. But my abs were so compromised that I folded under very high load very rapidly and had a very severe spinal flexion injury, some partial rupture of L4 or L5 S1. And over the course of time, I've been able to rehab a lot of that, but a significant amount of the loss of, say, like lower body strength, I just had to shift to mainly unilateral loading. I don't really squat or deadlift heavy. I've been doing some kin stretch for the past couple of years with some different folks, and that has got me back in the game better. But anything very heavy, I feel it in my back. Like I've found some strategies for the better part of 10 years, I could not really squat or deadlift. And so I'm back to a spot where I can squat and deadlift, but it's like low 200 pounds. And so, to answer that question, orthopedically, I don't know if I could get back to that. Like, I don't know if I would need like a back disc fusion or something. And then, what am I giving up there? In general, what we see is that after about 25, maybe definitely 25, like with sprinters, we tend to see a decrease in max power production, like the maximum, expression of fast twitch motor units. If we are training hard and smart, you can maintain that for a good 15, maybe 20 years. So really kind of hang on to that. But this is one of the things that makes me a little bit crazy about the protein phobic people and the folks that are really excited about like tons of fasting and whatnot. They're doing that mainly with the thought that they're going to avoid cancer or avoid, neurodegenerative disease or what have you. And the reality is that for anybody, even somebody eating a terrible standard American diet, cancer, diabetes, neurodegeneration, heart disease is all a potential that is worsened with poor diet. But sarcopenia and muscle loss is a guarantee for everyone. Like it is a 100% guarantee. And so putting some really due diligence into maintaining muscle mass and particularly those fast twitch muscle fibers is pretty critical as we age. So I have put some effort into that. But circling back to your original question, I could probably get a fair amount of that back because my upper body strength is not dissimilar to what I had at that, when I was 32, 35. The lower body is more impacted just from orthopedic issues. So I could probably scratch some of that back. And like, there were some examples of like Al Order was a shot putter
discus
thrower.
Yeah.
He was in three Olympics, had almost 12 years off, and then missed another Olympic team, a fourth Olympic team by one slot, and barely missed it. And he was in his mid-40s at that point. And it's interesting. Track and field athletes tend to age pretty well, and the field athletes are arguably better even than most of the rest of the people because they are consistently doing this kind of high rate of force development work and the kind of max power development. And so they're constantly putting demands on their system to maintain the fast twitch motor fibers. And that is something that I think translates really well with aging, but you've got to do it in a way that has some respect for your orthopedics also. Like you end up with a hip replacement or, a back fusion or something. And then how is that going to negatively impact the rest of your physicality, over the long haul?
Yeah. I think the, you talk about improving your technique, but also the intelligence element of adjusting your training over time from experience and from common sense, and maybe regulating your competitive intensity more to realize that you don't have to go slam yourself every day. And these new insights that are coming into the fitness world are really, I'm really glad to see finally, because we've been programmed to think that you just put that gas pedal on nonstop and that's how you get to the top. And now, even the leading athletes are kind of very, very much more structured with their stress and rest and emphasis on recovery.
It would be awesome if being a world champion was just a matter of being mentally tough and just grinding yourself down to a nub every day. Like that's easy, but easy with a caveat. Clearly there's some physical suffering that goes along with that. But what the real trick is figuring out how to pulse that. You know, it's like, when do you have to drive forward? When do you need to reel it back in? And what I've noticed, and this is part of the reason why I kind of lost interest in really working with like elite athletes, is that my main role as a coach was acting as a speed bump. Like these people were so pot committed into committing suicide via training that my main job was to try to slow them down. And that wasn't particularly interesting for me, you know, particularly in mixed martial arts combatives arena. And also I did some work with some endurance athletes, and the, you know, all props to people that wanted to get up and work hard and do all that type of stuff. But it was also kind of like, hey, what are you doing right now? Oh, I'm just hanging out. And I'm like, oh, that's funny. I just saw you running down the Esplanade and you're supposed to be taking a day off. And I know for a fact you're not. And so like, it was kind of the opposite of catching somebody with their hand in the cookie jar, you know, and that got old. Like that for me personally, that got old. And that's where the focus on helping people had significant health issues and trying to pull them back from type 2 diabetes or autoimmune disease. They were highly motivated to do it. They usually listened well, and they were coming from if I had some success there, maybe saved their life versus, oh yeah, somebody wins another world championship, that's really cool. But again, like almost any coach would have achieved that with them, so long as they just, you know, largely prevented the person from destroying themselves in the training process. You know, I couldn't claim any really deep insight into much beyond that. Yeah.
Yeah. You made an interesting comment there about the contrast between fasting like crazy and watching that protein and not stimulating those evil IGF-1 and mTOR versus trying to keep that muscle mass on and keep fit and keep strong. And I'm kind of wrestling with these insights personally. I'm age 55. I have all these athletic goals and, you know, enjoy being fit and recovering quickly. Mm-hmm. And then also, you know, not wanting to default into six small meals a day with the protein smoothie going constantly. And there seems like there's a little bit of nuance that you could comment on for people who, you know, have those goals, but also, you know, don't want to get cancer and all that kind of stuff that we're getting warned about.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The first article I had published on intermittent fasting was in 2005. And by 2006, I deeply regretted releasing it to the world because it was, it went out into this pool of folks that were mainly CrossFitters. And these were people that they would CrossFit 6 days a week. And then on their recovery day, they would do hot yoga and a 6 hour hike. And they would intermittent fast 22 hours a day, eat 5 grams of carbs a month. And, you know, 2 months into this thing, you're like, hey, my hair is falling out and I have no libido and what the heck's going on. And it's like, well, you took something that's supposed to be a little like a cherry on the sundae type deal, and you made it the whole meal, you know, effectively. And so I've always been intrigued by that middle ground of performance, health and longevity. But I also suspected really early on that there were shockingly rapid declining returns on investment on the performance side. Like once you get to a double body weight deadlift, you get to a body weight and a half back squat, you have a body weight and some change bench press. Unless you're a power athlete, how much more do you need? Like, and what are the things that you're going to give up to maintain that? It was kind of one side of that, kind of like looking at the kind of uber performance side. The other side, it has come to me a bit more recently, was really digging into the research on calorie restriction, you know, first in animal models and whatnot, and looking at what was going on there. And something that is suspiciously lacking is much research that looks at what does calorie restriction do when animals fed a species appropriate diet? And the very few studies that have been done on that, what it consistently does is it shortens their lifespan every single time. So what is happening in these calorie restriction studies, because dietetics wants and nutrition science wants to be precise, they feed these animals this highly processed lab chow type diet so that we know exactly how much protein, carb, fat they have, what their vitamins are, what their minerals are. So on the one hand, it's kind of laudable because they're trying to introduce accuracy and precision into this story. But at the end of the day, what these animals are eating is a shockingly highly processed diet. And if we know anything, eating less of a highly processed diet is probably better than eating more of it. And so at the end of the day, I think that virtually everything that we associate as beneficial with a calorie restricted diet is simply reflecting that you are protecting the animal from eating a super processed diet. Because again, there's not very many studies where they look at a species appropriate diet, say like for mice or rats or something like that. But the few of them that are there, it's really interesting. You do not see a survival advantage for these animals when they're eating kind of species appropriate diet. And funny enough, what you do see is an enhancement of longevity in these animals because they're living in basically like a safe modern world, but eating a species appropriate diet. Okay, that's interesting. So, and again, circling back around, we don't know that tons of fasting and protein restriction is going to save us from cancer or neurodegenerative disease or really anything else. It's totally speculative. The extrapolation that's being done is from animals that are overeating currently. We know that overeating accelerates the problems of cancer, diabetes, neurodegenerative disease, and whatnot. We also seem to see very, very little of these problems in environments in which animals are not chronically overfed. So this is where I'm just very suspicious that once you get to a spot where you're eating adequate protein, which I think is actually a lot more than what most people are eating, and it doesn't mean you need 6 meals a day, but you should probably not eat 1 meal a day. Something crazy like 2 meals and a snack might actually be good for both pulsing these growth signals, but also not being buried under growth signals. So like, you know, something insane like 2 or 3 meals a day might actually not be a bad idea, and doing some timing around, you know, exercise and stuff like that. But again, circling back, all of these chronic degenerative diseases are a potential, but sarcopenia and loss of muscle mass is a guarantee with aging. Like the only way you avoid that is by dying. And what I've noticed when we used to do these things called in-person events and you would actually talk to people in real life is that I would meet folks and in chatting with them, it's like, hey, so what are you up to? Well, I'm just finishing up my fourth 72-hour fast this month or whatever, you know? And the person didn't look good. They didn't look healthy. They didn't carry any significant muscle mass. And to be honest and maybe a little harsh, they were indistinguishable from a raw vegan that had kind of drank that Kool-Aid too much, you know? And when I would talk to them about how much protein are you eating, how frequently are you eating, they had just kind of uniformly fallen off of this cliff where they had figured out a way of surviving on as few calories, as little protein, and as infrequent eating as was potentially possible. But they looked frail. Like if their car slid off an icy road and they went down an embankment, they didn't strike me as someone that was going to be able to climb back up to the top of that, generate some thermal energy to stave off like freezing to death while they're driving between Reno and Tahoe or something, you know? And that lack of resilience just didn't impress me, you know? And who knows, maybe I'll be proven wrong on this, but some very smart people are beating this drum of like, oh man, you know, caloric restriction, protein restriction, fasting. And I am just completely unimpressed with what they're selling on that stuff. And I guess one final piece on this is that because all of that is so speculative, I really just focus on, you know, like, so I've eaten more or less a ketogenic diet for the last 22 years. my cardiovascular health seems to be good, but if I'm going to die 5 years from now from a heart attack, I don't know what else I would do. Because if I introduce much more in the way of carbs into my diet and life, I don't feel good. I'm foggy headed. I have GI problems. And so do I want my life to kind of suck over the next 5 years to, you know, like, so I've really just gotten to this point where it's like, how do I look, feel, and perform my best now? And I've got a little bit of a hope that that's going to translate into some good things later. You know, it just struck me one final piece. The vegans and other kind of protein phobic people like to cite these studies about the blue zones. Mm-hmm. There was a fascinating paper that was written about the data collection around the blue zones. And it made the case that it comes from regions that have terrible record keeping, no birth certificates, and exceptionally high rates of pension fraud. So what happens is grandpa dies, and then the father assumes the role of grandpa. Nobody knows he died. He gets buried in the backyard. And then as far as the government knows, he's still alive. And now father has taken on grandpa's role so that he can take the pension. And this is rife through the areas that are characterized as blue zones. So that whole thing appears in to my mind to be an absolute hoax that has been spun into like all manner of just kind of bullshit along the way. And so lots of different things kind of zeroing in. And my thought it to maybe put a cherry on this sundae is I think if we lift weights, maintain adequate cardiovascular fitness, some good mobility, do things that are cognitively challenging, I think we can be really, really fit into our late 80s, maybe early 90s. And then we're going to die. And it should be like kind of a fallen off a cliff type thing, you know, kind of like Mark's stuff, you know, live long, die quick kind of deal. And I think that's very, very reasonable. Absent some sort of interesting medical intervention, I don't see people living to 110 or 120 consistently. Might happen on an aberrational type of gig, but
yeah, Dave Asprey's going to go 180, so that'll be an aberration.
The funny thing is, Dave isn't likely to make it to 70 because of the stuff that he does. I'll go on record that I'll be surprised if Dave makes it to 70, given some of the ridiculous stuff he does. So yeah, I think it's actually going to be fractional compared to what he's claiming. Yeah.
Besides that, no controversy from Rob Wolf about Greg Glassman's programming and the blue zones and the incredible, you know, just momentum.
I don't know that there's any pet theory out there that I didn't just like walk up and like pee in their punch bowl with all of that. Yeah,
That's why we love you, man. I'm you know, my goal is to kind of you know, shoot straighter and be more, you know, entirely forthcoming with my opinions on the show. And I'm doing a whole show about it actually. But you know, when you're out there, you know, throwing these ideas out, that's what advances the conversation. And, you know, thinking critically, is a wonderful exercise. I contend that this, you know, compelled me to get there when I listened to the carnivore rationale from Paul Saladino and Sean Baker saying, hey, you know, these plant foods might not be good for you and, you know, you don't need them for health. And, you know, it shattered like the only common ground that we still had from the vegan community and the primal paleo, everyone's eating their big salad. And now it's like, oh shit, we gotta backpedal even further. But it's a good exercise to just challenge these beliefs and not stay fixed and rigid.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So regarding that, you know, I guess you'd call it a dilemma maybe of, you know, how much nutritious food should I eat? We know we don't need any crappy calories for any sake, even an elite athlete, but in determining that path, could we look at body composition? And if you're in, you know, adverse body composition zone, do we have a different set of parameters to choose from versus a guy who's going for longevity, preservation of muscle mass, athletic goals, staying away from cancer, heart disease risk, and all that?
Yeah, so and that's a really good point that I didn't make clear there at the beginning. If folks find some fasting beneficial as part of, say, like a weight loss process, that's fantastic. The little bit of pushback I would provide even there, though, is I would really encourage people. The big problem that I see with people using fasting as, say, like the sole means of weight loss is someday you have to eat again. And the food that you were eating before is this hyperpalatable processed crap that you know, bypasses the neuroregulation of appetite and encourages us to overeat. And so if fasting is kind of the main tool you use, then you didn't likely develop tools and patterns that are going to allow you to navigate the modern world. And if you want to eat one day, don't eat one day, and that's going to be your life, I guess that's one way to do that. But again, if you know, thinking about this from kind of a health and longevity perspective, lift weight. Like, I would encourage people, if you're not lifting weights at all, for the love of God, do some strength training. And it could just be like a circuit machine deal where you go in and you get one movement and you're very lightweight, do it 12, 15 reps, a little heavier weight, 8 or 10 reps, a little heavier. And you just keep doing that until you can only do like 3 or 4 reps, then move to the next thing. Work your way around the circuit, 10 or 15 minutes, do some mobility work, done. Like, it doesn't have to be super, super complex. I would recommend doing maybe a little bit of other stuff, but some people hate the gym. So I get it. Mm. Like, get in, get out. It's like a military exercise. Like, you know, spend as little time on the ground as you possibly can, but you're not doing strength training or resistance training. Do that. If you're doing some resistance training, but you're contemplating, should I do a 72-hour fast this month or a 48-hour fast? I would ask the question, I would suggest that doing a third or fourth day of strength training per week is going to be more beneficial than an additional day of fasting per month, would be my crazy used car salesman pitch on that, you know? And, it's interesting. Lifting weights improves autophagy. Drinking coffee improves autophagy. Getting adequate sun on our skin reduces all-cause mortality. As great as smoking or not smoking. And this is stuff that we know, we can take it to the bank. It's well understood. It makes us feel better today. So this is the type of stuff when people are doing these cost benefit analyses that I'm kind of like, go get some sun on your skin, even if it's 5 minutes in a low pressure UVA, UVB tanning bed. You're not going to get a tan, but you're going to feel better and you're going to reduce systemic inflammation. Don't use it to tan, use it to supplement, you know, basically sunlight or what have you. If you're contemplating more fasting, how about lifting more weights, you know, or doing some sort of new cognitive endeavor like jujitsu or tennis or a guitar or something like that. Like, I just see there are these things that are so well understood, whereas this just insistence on fasting and protein avoidance is entirely speculative in my opinion. Like, and what people cite as data, I think has just been horribly misrepresented, again, because it's really looking at, is the overfed state bad? Yes. But once you land on something that looks like ancestral eating and you're not overeating, I just think that the return on investment from additional fasting or protein restriction is slim or none, particularly when compared to getting some sun on your skin, doing cognitively engaging activities, and just trying to put on a you know, 5 more pounds of muscle mass.
Whew, this is pretty heavy, man, because we're shattering a lot of the strongest notions, and the amazing sensation of fasting in culture now is the key or the direct path to health. And so you're saying a lot of the research is on animals eating junk food and then eating less junk food, and then we're taking that to town.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, I am a remarkably unpopular person most places.
That's why he has to keep moving around from yeah. California to Nevada to ousted, Texas.
Yeah.
Wow.
So yeah, it's and again, I could be wrong. Maybe tons of fasting and low protein is somehow going to lead to both longer life and a higher quality of life. Now, I don't remotely believe that is true. I think that a lot of the folks that are looking at this stuff are very, very smart, but almost smart to a fault, where they get so down in the mechanistic weeds that they don't pull back and just kind of look at the kind of evolutionary biology story. And also, again, like going back to like the Blue Zones story, most of that is just an outright lie. It's an outright fraud and fabrication that has been perpetuated. And the paper that was written about that has seen really remarkably broad circulation, but it hasn't really changed the awareness of questioning these Blue Zones as some sort of like beacons of hope and information and whatnot. So, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's easy to argue that you're pulling insights out of context. For example, the active population with the great social parameters, and oh, guess what? They eat a lot of plant foods, and they don't eat a lot of processed meat. And you know, the cause and effect starts to go in a circle. Where, yeah, if you have good family life and you're healthy and you're happy and you're getting away from all these modern stressors, they could feed you, you know, virtually anything that's not junk food, and they can. We got to find a carnivore-ish blue zone, you know, and then put it up there to just throw the diet thing into the proper context. Rather than, I mean, seems to me most people associate blue zones with like the diet part of the blue zones rather than
everything else. Yeah. Well, I just did a Salty Talk, one of my podcasts, on the Turkana, which is a pastoralist people in Africa. And they're interesting in that you still have a decent number of these folks living their traditional pastoralist life way. And they have about 8 different animals that they either take dairy from or eat the meat from. And they get upwards of 80% of their calories from animal products. And then you have these genetically effectively identical, you know, family members that have moved into more westernized situations, and they eat a very starch-based, more processed carbohydrate diet. And the free-living Turkana are remarkably healthy, effectively devoid of chronic degenerative disease. And then these folks that even a half a generation in, like they were born in the pastoralist life way, but then moved to the city, they are crushed by these chronic degenerative diseases. So we do have some natural experiments out there that look even closer along that more carnivore, more you know, kind of animal product centric kind of angle. But we also have the Katavans and, you know, some different folks that eat comparatively little in animal products. It's interesting on that topic. Ages ago, it struck me that the ability to eat grains, legumes, tubers, what have you, was wholly dependent on just getting enough animal products to protect you from those other foods, like you to basically offset like nutrient deficiencies and get enough of whatever the vital nutrients are in the animal products. And it occurred to me, but I never really articulated it until, you know, noodling on the opposite side of this thing, looking at it from kind of the more carnivore perspective.
Whew. So back to the optimal decision making of what, when, how much to eat in the diet. And this might be a good segue into Wired to Eat, because you talk about appetite. Well, let's read the subtitle: Turn Off Cravings, Rewire Your Appetite, and Determine the Foods That Work for You. So maybe we can tread down that path a little bit and ask, is the appetite going to be a great regulator of your caloric intake? And then my add-on to that question is, when I go into that low-carb realm, I notice that my appetite is much more stable. I'm actually not hungry for hours after I do a high-intensity sprint workout in the morning. So am I being stupid by not eating, or should I go there and deliberately consume calories because I'm an athlete and I want to recover, even though I'm not starving or feeling those sensations that are so familiar for people locked in that high carb, high insulin pattern?
Yeah, really good questions. And the best answer I can provide is, I don't know, but we might have some.
I knew it, man. I predicted it, because Dom D'Agostino said, I don't know, so many times during my first interview with him when we were writing the Keto Reset Diet. And I finally said, dude, that's your favorite answer. And he goes, watch out for the distinction between a good scientist and a good critical thinker versus someone who's a promoter. A good scientist says, "I don't know," all the time.
Well, I haven't said Rob Wolf's
in there, man.
I haven't said I don't know too much on this, but what I'm selling people on is lift more weights, eat more protein, and what have you. And I think that's fairly defensible. But when we look at appetite control, protein tends to be the most satiating macro that we have. And there is kind of an interesting inflection point with this where a significant amount of protein is highly satiating. If you eat more protein, you actually get more stimulation of the appetite because at some point we need either carbohydrate or fat as a cofactor to deal with protein. This is the whole rabbit starvation, kind of phenomena. So, for me, eating somewhere around like 150, 170 grams of protein per day, maybe 200 grams of protein per day, it's plenty for growth and maintenance. It provides great satiety. But when I've tinkered with things, if I get up around like 225 grams of protein, which is a lot, and it's hard to just do that protein, I'm actually hungrier then. So there's this kind of weird non-linearity to it. But like you have to really try to kind of get to that. So it's not something that folks get too often. For sure, something that happens, and we see this at both kind of the vegan side of the story and interestingly, the protein phobic keto side of the story, is that when people are eating very low protein intakes, and there are folks out in keto land that recommend 40 grams of protein total per day for grown men, that's not per meal, that's per day. I consistently see people with terrible body composition and they overeat because this protein leverage hypothesis suggests that all organisms eat to a protein minimum. And whether that's a cow grazing on grass versus clover, they will tend to prefer clover because it's more protein dense and therefore more generally more nutritious. Nutrients tend to be more densely associated with protein rich foods. And so any organism you care to look at, they tend to favor more protein dense sources of nutrition because they get more broad nutrition in that context. So I think so long as we're hitting adequate protein, which is somewhere around like a gram of protein per pound of body weight or a gram of protein per pound of ideal body weight, or it depends on whether people are losing weight or, they're an athlete or what have you, but it's generally more than what most people are eating. Mm-hmm. That tends to work out well. And if they're not hitting that protein, they tend to overeat whatever else it is that their dietary dogma allows them, whether it's carbs or fat. This is where I've seen folks in this ketogenic diet community where you're eating a ketogenic diet that's supposed to be like really satiating and they're gaining remarkable amounts of weight on it, on something that's supposed to be that others have claimed is impossible to gain weight on. And they'll do all kinds of crazy like cognitive dissonance things where it's like, well, the butter has just enough protein to stimulate insulin. And it's kind of like, give me a break, man. They're just, a relatively sedentary person that's eating 30 grams of protein a day doesn't need to eat a stick of butter. They need to eat more protein, So I think that's kind of that. And then on the recovery side, for someone like you, I don't know, like there's a fair amount of literature that suggests getting that nutrition post-workout enhances recovery. Like I think that there's some good literature to support that. There's some literature that suggests that fasting and low carb and what have you is kind of a hormetic stress, kind of aid, and it gooses fat adaptation and whatnot. But I mean, how many years have you eaten pretty low carb?
12, comparison to massively high carb years before that, right? And training too much and all those, different.
But I would make the case that you've probably sucked all the juice out of fat adaptation that you're going to get, So I'm going to be 49 in a month. You're 54, 55.
55.
Okay. So in my mind, for us, like, that performance is important and everything, but a key part of that performance is maintaining that muscle mass, you know? And so in my mind, that really kind of shifts some orientation towards, yeah, get that hard workout, get those hormetic stress elements from being keto adapted, from doing some fasted training, and then eat. And I wouldn't be surprised also if over the course of time, like, if you have habituated to not eating until later, then that is part likely of the reason why you're not mm-hmm. hungry till later. Like, your mm-hmm. circadian biology has kind of been trained to that. But I would personally kind of stack the deck a little bit favorably on that growth and recovery side, and just kind of give it a 1-year experiment and see how you do with it. Like, are there obvious upsides? Are there any obvious downsides? And kind of tinker with that. But I think the fact that you're already low carb, you're already doing some fasted training, how much more are you going to get out of it? You know, right. Pushing that recovery phase, you know, out. And it is, and some of the critics of say, like, keto and low carb, they're accurate in that it is a stressor. So training mm-hmm. is a stressor. Low carb can be a stressor. Fasting can absolutely be a stressor. How many of those things do we want to stack and daisy chain together? You know,
my cold water plunge. I forgot that too.
Oh, yeah. And it certainly couldn't be 70 degrees. It has to be 48 degrees. Like, for the love of God, you can die in it, other than Wim Hof, or unless you're really dialed in that breathing and have trained your brown adipose tissue to produce a lot of heat. You can die pretty goddamn quickly in 70 degree water. So this is something that will kill you in a matter of an hour or two if you are stuck in it. And that's not even wind or anything else. But I really like you brought that up. Like, 70 degree water is a fine hormetic stressor, and it doesn't make you rue the day that you were born going into it. But again, people are like, wow, man, well, I'm all the way down to 48 degrees and I had to break the ice on this thing and it's absolute misery. It's like, okay, if you want to adapt to that, like, again, Wim Hof and some people like that have adapted into that. And I don't think it poses the same type of physiological stress to them because they have adapted to it. But man, take some baby steps on that. Mm-hmm. 70 degree water is cold, and stick with that for 6 months or a year and then start ratcheting it down. Like, folks are in such a ridiculous hurry to try to get somewhere with this when, you know, 70 degree water is cold. It will kill you if you stay in it long enough. And it absolutely is good enough for, like, a hormetic stress response. You know,
you'll be shivering for a long time after one of those swim workouts when the pool heater's broken. I know that feeling. Yeah. I'm trying to get it over with quickly. So I'm going for lower water temperature in my chest freezer just because I don't want to spend 12 minutes. I'd rather spend 3. So hopefully that rationale makes sense, but
I would just, it's another one of those things there where dose response curves really do matter, you know? And like, if it's again, and I might be wrong, I might be completely wrong on all this stuff, but you may have, like, thermally adapted to this so that, say, like, your brown adipose tissue spins up and produces heat. And so it's not as stressful for you as, say, like, it would be for me. Like, being in 48 degree water is miserable for me. Like, I absolutely hate it. I just detest it. But I have slowly been doing my Wim Hof breathing. I've been tinkering with it, but I'm taking a 5-year approach to this thing. Like, I'm not really in a hurry to get anywhere because I know when I've done too much cold that I feel horrible later. Like, I'll feel pretty good in the moment because I've got a bunch of endorphins and then I crash and I'm actually doing something counterproductive. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I do 3 minutes in 68 or 65 degree water, I feel great and I feel great the whole day. Mm-hmm. So I've really been very careful at looking at that dose response curve to figure out, okay, what's optimizing everything that I have going on here.
Yeah, Kelly Starrett, when I first started getting into this, he said, don't go to the point of shivering because that's stupid and you're just showing off if you're trying to set a timer or something. Yeah. And back to your idea about experimenting and testing, I'm thinking of an insight that Tommy Wood shared with me. And he said, eat as much nutritious food as you can until you start adding body fat. And that's your curve right there, of course. Yeah. And that makes so much sense. And it's so simple. And they counsel their athletes that they work with. And, you know, for most people with the desire to drop that frustrating excess body fat, then you can try your fasting and do all those things. But yeah, good. Geez, Rob, this has been pretty wild times. I want to plug Sacred Cow, and I guess we can just give a little tidbit about the film and the book, and then people can dive in for further details.
Yeah. So Diana Rogers and I worked for four and a half, five years on Sacred Cow, the book and film, and it tackles the ethical, environmental, and health considerations of a meat-inclusive food system. So we try to take on some of the things like meat gives you cancer. Meat it disproportionately produces greenhouse gases. Producing meat disproportionately uses resources. And there's truth and lies to a lot of this stuff. And so it takes a lot of effort to unpack and unwind all these things. I'll share an example. Again, I wouldn't want anybody to read this and just believe me. It's like, oh, Rob's a good guy. Great. You know, I would really encourage people to get in and actually vet the material that we cite in there. But this is possibly a decent example of us trying to be ethical and to try to do the very best job that we could. When we looked at the question of, is pastured meat more nutritious than conventional meat? We looked and looked and looked and looked, and we looked at every scrap of data we could find, and we had an independent party come in and look at, you go answer this question. We didn't even provide the resources. We paid this person to go do this independently. What we and they, and this person is a PhD in nutritional science, came up with is that there's virtually no difference between pastured meat and conventional meat. Now, there is a massive difference nutritionally in dairy, in eggs, in wild-caught versus farm seafood. But when you really look at meat itself, there's just not that big of a difference. And people will get all verklempt over differences in omega-3 content of pastured versus conventional meat. There's virtually no difference between the two. Pastured meat has a tiny bit more omega-3, and where this becomes a complete non-issue, 2 ounces of salmon has as much omega-3s as 8 pounds of pastured meat. If you're looking for omega-3s, beef is not where you look for it. It is the long and short of that. Now, there are amazing reasons why pasturing or holistic management of grazing animals is environmentally superior, it is ethically superior, but you cannot make a credible scientific case that it is nutritionally superior. And again, pastured dairy is shockingly more nutritious than conventional dairy. Pastured eggs, same deal, and wild-caught fish, same deal. But when we're talking about beef, lamb, et cetera, it's just not the case. And we have had people just lose their minds on us. They're like, well, you've got to have this wrong. And I'm like, have you written a book on this? Like, did you spend 5 years reading? Well, no, this guy said something. I'm like, well, I don't know who that guy is. And he didn't put as much time into this. And like, honestly, we considered just lying about this. We're like, what's the big deal? Let's just lie. Because it'll be like the vegans. We'll just lie. And then it's like this wall of truth. Because the vegans always do that. Like, of course, animal, you know, it's good for your bones. It's good for this. It's good for that. And we'll ignore all the little inconvenient truths. But the reason why we didn't is that a vegan doctor or researcher could get in and look at our claim that conventional meat and pastured meat are identical. They could easily prove that that point is not true. And then it calls into question every other thing that we perhaps got accurate in that thing. So we really did the best job that we could to be correct in this, even when the science led us to an answer that wasn't satisfying for our preconceived notions around it. But man, I tell you, we've had more pissing, moaning, and backbiting over that from like our meat elitist, paleo, primal, keto scene than we've gotten from the vegans. The vegans, I think, have we did such a good job on the book that the vegans did something smart, and they just don't talk about it at all. They don't want any attention. They don't want any hubbub, because we wrote it as like the absolute manifesto response to like Game Changers and Cowspiracy and all the rest of that. So we've had no negative reviews, no pushback from the vegan quarter, but we've had a remarkable amount of pissing and moaning from like people that we would otherwise think would kind of be on our team. And it mainly relates back to this this topic of like, no, pastured meat must be nutritionally superior to conventional meat. And I wish that was the case, but it just isn't. Not with the current data that we have.
Wow. What an interesting strategy to ignore it. And maybe we should do the same with Game Changers and say, oh, I haven't seen it, don't know anything about it. Next question. Well, instead of trashing it and attacking and giving all that attention to, someone has to go watch it now since we've heard how much criticism it receives.
Yeah, there is a little bit of an asymmetric warfare, though, in that, big name movie producers are backing these things. Mm-hmm. Netflix backs these things. The film Sacred Cow, which is a companion to the book, Diana got it to the highest tier of leadership at Netflix, and everybody below that was incredibly excited about the film. It hit that upper tier of leadership, and then they went dark on us and never said another thing. And so there's an asymmetric warfare that's being fought there, where I think the vegans, when we have something good to say, are smart in a way because they've got the total upper hand, like political culture, social media, all the do-goodery kind of woke people are all very, very, very pro-vegan. And so it's a smart move for them. They totally have the upper hand with everything currently. And so some upstart film and book that really has the right of things, by all means, ignore it. Like don't shine a light on it. Don't get anybody curious about it. We unfortunately do have kind of a different task at hand, because everything from school lunches to World Health Organization dietary and climate change recommendations, social media, like the algorithms of what Facebook, Twitter, Instagram do and don't suppress online are all very meat, not favorable towards meat. So we do have a very different battle to fight there.
Just to call attention. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, man. Give me the rationale why we need to check on our electrolytes, and then I'll let you go. I appreciate your time so much, but I know you're really excited about this new project. And it seems like there's been a lot of a struggle in this realm where people don't even know why their diet's not working, and they haven't addressed the electrolytes properly. So LMNT, let's wind them up. Here he goes.
Yeah, LMNT's kind of an interesting story. Like I've eaten a low-carb diet for 22 years, pretty much on the keto side. I have generally done well with it, but I noticed that I did pretty well with like gymnastics and weightlifting, but thing kind of high motor activities, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, legit intervals. I really struggled on it. Like I didn't have a low gear for it. And my solution with that was reintroducing some carbs. And then I didn't really feel as good cognitively. I had GI problems. And I was kind of back and forth on this stuff. And it was just a constant bugger for me. And I started hanging out with two guys, Luis Villasenor and Tyler Cartwright. They founded Keto Gains. Great guys. And they've probably worked directly with more people on intelligently formulated ketogenic diets than like anybody on the planet. Like they just have a huge community and do really good work. But I started hanging out with them. I'm like, hey, could you guys look at what I'm doing here? I'm trying to do jujitsu. Here's what I'm eating. What else do I need to do? And they took a quick look and they're like, you're not getting enough electrolytes, specifically sodium. And I was like, oh no. I salt my food. I'm a biochemist. I know what's going on, And so I had secured these guys as my coaches. And what I did was what virtually everybody does when they have a coach. You ignore them. You ignore their good advice. And you don't listen to it. And so a good year went by and they patiently were waiting for me to have my breaking point. And I circled back around to them again. And they were like, no, man, you need to up your electrolytes, specifically sodium. So So I did. And it was literally like magic happened. Like, I just couldn't even believe it. When you think about it, the basic currency of life is sodium potassium pumps. This is what drives electron transport and ATP process. Every thought we have is an action potential driven by sodium potassium pumps, you know, and every muscle fiber we fire and whatnot. So it's not surprising that if you are not on point with electrolytes, then you're not going to be at your best. You're not going to feel good. You're going to have kind of, you know, foggy headed and whatnot. And people are kind of familiar with this, like the keto flu and problems with shifting towards a lower carb type of diet, even just kind of eating paleo primal, but you're putting in fruit and stuff. People will still experience this. And that's kind of one part of this story. Then you've got the other part of this story, which is the demands, the increased demands for electrolytes, specifically sodium, if it's hot, if it's humid, if you're at high altitude, if it's very cold air because it's had the moisture taken out, high physical activity. The American Council of Sports Medicine, depending on your size and the environment that you're active in, recommend somewhere between 7 to 10 grams of sodium per day for active athletes. Mm-hmm. And this is nowhere near where people generally are. And then interestingly, the other side of this, when some research was done on type 2 diabetic heart patients, and they looked at all like morbidity, mortality within those groups, the low ebb of morbidity, mortality was at 5 grams of sodium intake per day. And it was a U-curve. It was very steep at low sodium intake. So we had very high morbidity and mortality at 2 grams per day. It went down to 5 grams per day. And then you had to, it was a flat curve on the higher side. You had to get out to nearly 10 grams of sodium per day in this sick heart patient group to have the morbidity and mortality that you saw in the 2 gram a day people. So it was more dangerous to be low sodium than higher sodium. So we kind of had these things as these brackets, and we recognized that folks in this community and beyond, even more mainstream, really would benefit from better electrolyte management. And what we did initially was we created this pretty slick downloadable guide to make this stuff we called Keto Aid. And it was, you know, this much salt and this much no salt and this much like magnesium citrate. Put some lemon juice in it, put some stevia in it, go be achieve. And we had like 500,000 downloads for this thing. Like people loved it. And, but then we started getting tagged on social media where folks were like, hey, love the Keto Aid. But when I was going through TSA, the guys didn't like my 3 bags of white powder, LOL, you know? And so we just started asking the question, would some sort of a convenient, ready, you know, add water mix kind of electrolyte thing, would that be helpful for people? And we got together and created the company like coming up on two years ago now. And it's just done great. We're the official hydration sponsor of Team USA Weightlifting. We've had significant inroads into the special operations community within the military. We have a good number of NFL, Major League Baseball, basketball, like all the kind of big, you know, team sports stuff, hockey have kind of been buying into this. And it's been cool in that when people try the product, they usually feel better immediately. And then they're just kind of hooked. Like it has a very tight feedback loop on it. Mm-hmm. Like if you're at all fatigued, lethargic, just not feeling well, you get your electrolytes fixed and you start feeling better immediately. So, I mean, that is a very long-winded answer to that. But yeah, Element has been motoring along pretty well and pretty exciting. And we've had some interesting inroads into some medical conditions. We have a study that's going to happen at Vanderbilt looking at Element, basically looking at the effect of supplemental electrolytes on breast milk production, because we had this breastfeeding community go crazy over Element. Like people were very minimal breast milk production, then they used Element and their breast milk exploded. Mm-hmm. And there's some pretty good mechanistic reasons for why that is. And then we really had some great adoption within this POTS community, the postural orthostatic tachycardia community, which is a phenomenon where the individual goes from seated to standing and they can't maintain normal blood pressure, and people can pass out and they can die because of traumatic brain injury. They hit their head on the way down. And it's a surprisingly common condition. And it's understood in those communities that sodium is important, but nice ways of getting in sodium are kind of tough to find. So like we just, we did a huge POTS awareness campaign 2 months ago on social media, and just had a really, really phenomenal kind of love given from those folks for shining some light on this problem.
Fantastic. I'm in, man. I got to go get some Element. Listeners,
well, you should have received some. I thought that we...
it's in my P.O. box waiting there. Yeah, that's a very nice gesture. I appreciate it. Everyone, we got to go grab some. You get it on Amazon, or should we go to the website?
Amazon, and then drinkelement.com is the main website. And we have a ton of just educational material over there, not just electrolyte related, but on a lot of different topics. Yeah.
And the best place to catch up to you and follow everything you're doing?
The bulk of my time is over at the Healthy Rebellion now, which is our membership site. I do the social media equivalent of throwing hand grenades over a fence and running at this point. Like I post things on Instagram, but I do almost no curation of comments because I'm just over it. There are a lot of great people on there, and there are a lot of complete jerks too. And the jerk factor has kind of wore me down. And so I'm still trying to provide some value by posting some stuff on there. But what I do is I post things that are interesting there, and we discuss it in the Healthy Rebellion. So if folks want to go check that out, that is definitely where I hang out.
Rob Wolf, everybody, what an awesome show. Thank you so much for setting everything straight. So much to think about, and good luck to you with your next move and all the future ambitions.
Thank you. And hopefully I'm not wrong on everything I just spieled about for 1 hour.
Da, 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 da.